This is Morning Edition on Vermont Public Radio. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Good morning. There have been global conferences and tenuous agreements, but governments worldwide have yet to enact the kind of meaningful steps to reduce carbon emissions to the extent most scientists say would reverse or at least slow the trend of harmful global warming. On a more local level, Jonathan Mingle has been writing about soot. It's a contributor to climate change. 3 billion people in the developing world still burn solid fuels like wood, dung, and coal. They burn these materials in stoves that create soot or black carbon, contributing to both climate change, respiratory illness, and even premature death. Mingle traveled to a remote Himalayan village in northern India to work with a community there on passive solar heating methods, and that journey sparked several years of reporting that culminated in his book, Fire and Ice, Soot, Solidarity, and Survival on the Roof of the World. Jonathan Mingle now joins us to talk about those findings and a bit about how soot is even affecting us as Vermonters. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
It's good to be with you, Mitch.
Now, first, we all know roughly what soot looks like, but what is black carbon? How big of a contributor is it to climate change?
Black carbon are these ultrafine particles that are produced anytime you have incomplete combustion of pretty much any fuel. So it could be dung, it could be wood. It could be a fossil fuel like diesel or kerosene. And there's been a lot of emerging science on black carbon. What they've concluded is that it's the number two contributor to climate change after carbon dioxide. So when you add up all of its effects through direct heating in the atmosphere, when these tiny dark particles are suspended, they soak up sunlight, they turn it into heat, but also when they settle out onto the surface of snow and ice, they accelerate the melting of glaciers and snowfields. So when you tally up all those different effects, black carbon is the second biggest contributor.
That is stunning. And your research has shown that 4.3 million people die each year from household air pollution exposure. Do I have that figure right?
Yeah, that's right. That's the latest estimate of the burden of disease from the World Health Organization. It's a staggering number. There are 3 billion people around the world, mostly in the developing world, who rely on solid fuels, polluting fuels for cooking, heating, and lighting. And so that number is just an estimate based on what people use for cooking and heating because they don't have access to clean alternatives like gas and electricity, what you and I probably use in our kitchens.
You know, that reminds me a little bit of the problem that we used to hear about years ago, and I'm sure it's still a problem, with the rainforests and many of the indigenous people there who were, you know, feeling like they had to clear cut these forests to make a living, to survive. And it sounds like you're talking about people in very remote areas like you traveled to who don't have an alternative. What can they do? They've got to heat food. They've got to eat.
That's right. And, you know, in the village that I write about in the book, Kumik, which is in a very remote part of India, very high altitude valley called Zanskar, there aren't a lot of trees that grow at that altitude, and what few trees there are, they mostly use for building materials. So mostly they burn animal dung for cooking, but also for heating. The winter's very long. It's very cold. If they had an alternative, they would use it. But being at the end of some very long supply chains, they just can't afford it.
Well, is anything being done about it? Are the governments in India, let's say, aware of this problem and trying to do anything about that?
Yeah, there are a lot of efforts going on. It's a tricky engineering challenge, but it's also a tricky behavioral challenge because in different parts of the world, people cook in very different ways. They cook with different fuels and have different preferences. So you're never going to design a stove that's one size fits all, but there are some interesting companies. One I write about in the book is called BioLite, and it's based in Brooklyn, and they've developed a camping stove for sale on the recreational market here in the U.S., and it's powered by wood, you know, twigs, pine cones that you find at your campsite, and it generates electricity to charge your phone or an LED light, and they're using the sales of that stove to subsidize the development of an affordable stove that uses the same technology for sale to households in sub-Saharan Africa or South Asia where this problem is most prevalent.
So speaking of stoves, I want to talk about Vermont for a minute, and EPA data shows that Vermonters produce the most emissions from burning wood per capita, 22 pounds. That's nearly double the figure for second place Wisconsin. This is not all that surprising. I mean, wood stoves are so prevalent in Vermont, but about half the wood stoves in the state are the older, inefficient, dirtier models. Are Vermonters contributing to the global soot problem, and do they face some of the same health risks?
Yes, I would say their health is by far the greater concern. I think if you added up Vermont's contribution to the global soot problem in climate terms, it would be pretty negligibly small. But yeah, you should be concerned if you're near a polluting source, because what you worry about is the fraction of pollution that you're breathing in or exposed to. And there are a lot of wood stoves out there that are the older ones before the EPA certifications were instituted, I believe in the 90s, and they can be polluting devices. And if you're downwind or live right nearby or use one yourself, you might want to think about swapping it out for a newer one, which really does burn a lot more cleanly.
Are those newer ones cost prohibitive, though? I wonder if many people are holding on to their old stoves just because the new ones are expensive.
They do cost more. It's a similar problem you find in parts of India that I write about in the book. I brought one of these BioLite stoves, for instance, to this valley, Zanskar, and showed it to some friends, and they were impressed, but their first question was, how much does it cost? It's the same concern wherever you go. I guess I would say to that in terms of fuel savings here in Vermont, but also reducing the health risks for yourself, but also your neighbors, it pays for itself.
Jonathan, you write in your book that your research on black carbon became sort of like pulling the thread on a sweater. You realize it's connected to everything else. And does the problem of global warming ever seem just overwhelming to you in its complexity and in its far-reaching tentacles, if you will? I mean, what is your vision about how we're tackling this going ahead in the future?
It's an incredibly daunting problem if you look at it in its entirety. But one reason I was drawn to black carbon is that I think it's a hopeful story, because the big lessons I drew are, one, we can solve these daunting problems. We have the wherewithal. We have the know-how. But two, the only way we will solve them is through solidarity, cooperative action. I mean, that's why I snuck the word solidarity into the subtitle of a book about soot.
And Jonathan Mingle is the author of Fire and Ice, Soot, Solidarity, and Survival on the Roof of the World. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Mitch.